I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast spoiler specials. This one is dedicated to Jordan Foyt Roberts' King Kong extravaganza. Giant apes everywhere. Well, just one, really. Kong Skull Island, which came out last week. Hopefully, you've had time to catch up with the film, for this is a spoiler special, and as such, discusses all manner of plot revelations, third act developments, just how hairy Kong is, all that sort of stuff. We're going to talk about it all. And by we, I mean Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And Nick Desemlian.
Hello.
Who was on sets of this movie, and I say sets because he travelled the world with Kong Skull Island.
I was very lucky. I got to go to three continents. I got to go to Hawaii. I got to go to Australia, and I got to go to Vietnam. I know those are not all continents.
But they're on different continents.
But they're different, and it rained everywhere I went. Everywhere I went, it brought rain and ruined
wow.
shooting days.
Why does it always rain on you?
I know.
Is it because you lied when you were 17?
Might be.
I can either confirm or deny it this time. So we're going to be talking about the film in great detail very, very soon. But first, we're going to have an interview with Jordan Foyt Roberts, the director of the movie. John Nugent of this parish sat down with him recently and talked about the film in great detail. So once again, if you have not seen Kong Skull Island, stop listening, go and see it, and then come back and listen. Because here is Jordan Foyt Roberts. Enjoy.
We are delighted to welcome to the Empire Podcast the director of Kong Skull Island, Jordan Foyt Roberts. Welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. We're going to get right into spoiler territory.
Let's do it.
This is a spoiler podcast.
Spoil it up.
So we'll start right, instead of the beginning, we'll start right at the end.
Okay.
The post-credit sequence, which has got a lot of people talking already. It's really interesting. What can you tell us about that? Was that always in place from the start? Who came up with that
idea? We had a bunch of different variations of that. You know, we actually shot that during principal photography. We shot that while we were in Australia, so it's not something we shot after the fact. And ironically, it was not attached to the movie for a long time because somebody decided that it didn't jive with like the future of Monarch. And okay. It really was the last minute thing over the last couple weeks that, you know... It's that ironic part of filmmaking where like somebody else suddenly says like, hey, that thing's really cool, why isn't that on the movie? And then everyone goes, oh yeah, that needs to be on the movie. And then you sit there and you're like, guys, I've been saying this for months now that this should be on the movie and people are gonna love it.
Yeah.
But we had a ton of variations of that scene. There was one version of that scene where like Conrad and Weaver were on a boat in the Arctic Ocean with Brooks, and they're like, what are we waiting for? And Brooks is like, hold on. And then like Godzilla surfaces and okay. like breaks a bunch of ice.
Yeah.
But then we're like, well, that doesn't really jive with Godzilla then, because in Godzilla they say it hasn't surfaced since, you know, the atomic bomb test. So there were a lot of variations of that, and then it sort of became this much more stripped down scene that hopefully, you know, the response to it honestly is kind of like even shocked me a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it seems to just be evocative.
Yeah. Was there a lot of you know, negotiations with Legendary and Toho and a lot of
Oh yeah, it was a big thing with Toho. You know, they are rightfully very protective of their monsters and their creatures, as they should be. Mm-hmm. So you know, that was not just an easy thing of saying, let's put Rodan and yeah. and Mothra and, you know, all of these creatures in here, and you know, think nothing of it.
Yeah.
It was certainly like there were conversations that went back and forth for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So we've gone to the end. Let's start right back at the beginning then. You joined the project when it's already in motion, and there was already a script, which you've sort of completely revised to your own designs, I guess.
Yeah. When I got involved, or when they pitched it to me, they were like, hey, we want to do this Skull Island movie, and yeah, we want it to ultimately connect to this larger monsterverse we're building. But their version of the script took place in like 1917.
Right.
It was like a different kind of adventure movie. Kong actually was barely in the script. It had more to do with Kong almost was treated like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park, where he's like an important part of it, but it wasn't his movie. And you know, I sort of said, guys, I love you and I love King Kong, and I think it's cool that you guys are building this monsterverse, but I don't understand why this movie has a reason for being. And the script was very cool, but it just wasn't for me. I didn't understand how I could make that movie and why that movie had a reason for being. Audiences are skeptical these days. They're skeptical of franchises. They're skeptical of cash grabs. And so... it was also trying to play a little bit of the Beauty and the Beast game, you know, and so I was just like, you know what, I just don't think that this is for me. And the cool thing about Legendary and Warner Brothers is their response was sort of saying, whoa, you know, like the classic thing in Hollywood is like, the more you say no to something, the more someone's like suddenly, yeah, hey, wait, let's talk about this. And so I went away that weekend and started thinking about whether there was a version of this movie that I would see. And for a lot of reasons, first and foremost being the fact that in the early 70s, we launched the Landsat program, which were these satellites we put up into the sky and started looking down at the Earth, and we were starting to map the Earth. And I loved the idea that that felt like a credible way to sort of have a modern day take on this thing. And as soon as that happened, then suddenly choppers and napalm and sunsets and Hendrix playing and just this like quintessential idea of like Apocalypse Now and King Kong or a Vietnam War movie like Platoon or something with like a creature feature or like a Harryhausen film, you know, like that aesthetic genre mashup. And that's even beyond the thematics of the time period, which were super interesting to me because they're sort of a black mirror of what was happening now. That idea just seared itself in my head, and I went and I pitched them that idea the following Monday, legitimately thinking they were going to laugh me out of the room. You know, it's one of these things where I was like, I would see that movie,
yeah,
and I would make that movie, and I feel like my friends would want to see that movie. And it was like, I've never seen that movie before, and I think we live in a time when all these movies feel routine and feel like you've seen them before. So I pitched it thinking they were going to be like, you're an idiot, get out of this room right now. And instead they said, okay, you know what, let's figure that out. So yeah, it completely was a page one rewrite, completely threw out that old script and just kind of riffed from there.
So there's no element at all from that original script that made it to the final?
At one point they did get on a boat in that script and they kind of go up river. Look, I haven't read that script in a long time, and I think there's very cool stuff. I remember there being very cool stuff in that script, but the writer who came on didn't really read that script, and you know, the writer who wrote that script eventually came back and did a bunch of very cool stuff for us because he's a very talented guy. But no, I don't think that there were. I don't think they were like they were the creatures in that movie were kind of like dinosaur based, and like had a weird zeppelin in it. It was a very, very different film.
Okay, so talk me through the opening scene. I read somewhere that was quite different to begin with. Like it starts out with just two soldiers, but was there more of a war element to begin with?
No, at one point there was. That scene is almost exactly how I envisioned it.
Okay.
There's two funny things with that scene. One is the first version of the cold open that popped, you know, right now it's like this weird sort of like riff off of almost like a spaghetti western thing on this beach. That's this weird like hell in the Pacific, two soldiers trying to kill each other, two countries trying to kill each other, and then suddenly being presented with something much greater than themselves and sort of realizing how foolish their like petty squabbles are. At one point, an actor we were talking to was like, oh, there should be a dogfight in this guy. There should be a dogfight. And so the studio was like, well, let's put a dogfight in the movie. It's like, no, like, this, it's unnecessary. We don't need to see a dogfight. Like, it's more evocative just seeing this guy fall out of the sky. But my alternate opening to that... I'm going to get in trouble for this. The alternate opening to the movie to me that I initially pitched them, and this is true, and they said, you're crazy, we can't do that, was I wanted to have... It's World War II, so like I was like, oh, man, like a, you know, a full squad comes to this beach, mm-hmm. and like they're just killing each other. It's like just island warfare. They're just battling each other, and then suddenly this giant monkey that looked a lot like the monkey in the last King Kong movie comes out of the jungle, and they just kill it, and it's dead. And then you just sit there sitting, being like, "Wait, did they just kill King Kong?
Oh, wow!
Did they just kill the hero of this film?" And then you would hear this roar, and then you would see this like this much bigger creature that's our creature, and you're right. Like, oh, that's this movie. But to me, that was like the crazy version of me being like, we need to send a message that this isn't like the other King Kong movies that you've seen. And they were like, you can't do that. That's crazy. But I love that cold open scene, like them on the beach, this hell in the Pacific thing. That's actually one of my favorite scenes in the movie that I think actually really subtly communicates how like left of center the whole, like, I actually laugh at that scene, like him missing with the bullets is like so so weird and goofy and strange.
Yeah.
And I love it.
And it's a great introduction to Kong as well. I mean, it really feels like a big dramatic movie moment that, you know, you have to sit up and...
Well, that, and I also just, I wanted to show Kong from the very beginning. I wanted him in the first scene. You know, I want, like, yeah. I love what Garrett did with Godzilla, and I think he did such a good job with that film that I so fundamentally didn't want to withhold the creature. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they played that game, and they did that so well, and I don't like the expectation that these movies have to withhold the creature.
Yeah.
You know, which is funny, because in most horror, like, less is generally more.
Yeah.
You know, like, the less you see of the xenomorph, the less you see of a lot of these monsters, or, you know, villain creatures is generally more evocative. But I was so inspired by things like Bong Joon-ho's The Host that just put the creature out there, and then it's about how that creature affects your story and your characters.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about Kong and his sort of design? I mean, he's the tallest he's ever been in this movie, right? He's about 100 feet or
well
so.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, he's technically taller than Toho's Godzilla versus Kong, you know. There's like a weird technicality with that.
Yes.
You know, whether or not you count that like a canon movie is like a whole different conversation. Yeah, he's huge, and it's funny because people want to have like a really negative view of that at first and be like, oh, he's really big because they want him to fight Godzilla. And it's actually like, no, that was one of the things that I wanted to do early on, was I wanted him to be big, and that big because I wanted the first instinct that you or I had, if you were to look at it, was to not say, that's a big monkey or that's a big ape. Like, whoa, that ape is suffering from gigantism. But to have the first synapse fire in your brain, say, that's a god. Yeah. I'm looking at a god. And then what does that do to you? Does that make you like the atheist, the believer, the agnostic? You know, like, what does that inspire within you? Does it make you want to kill it or protect it or whatever? And, you know, with that design, like, it really was intended to be sort of a throwback to that 1933 version where he was like a classic movie monster. Mm. He's not just a gorilla. You know, he's not just a big ape. Like, he's his own species, and he's got those heightened, like, cartoonish elements and the big brow and the exaggerated feature and the bug eyes. And then I just wanted to take him and, like, almost stand him even more upright, like, make him into this god and this lonely god and this like, protector of the island with this thankless task, and for him to carry himself with the nobility of a king, but to have, like, this melancholy tragedy underneath him.
Hmm. And yeah, I'm fascinated by his sort of combat style in this movie. I mean, he's a proper brawler, but he's also like an improviser. He finds weaponry wherever he can. Well, I mean, what was the inspiration there?
Well, part of that is me trying to like just thinking about like, what haven't I seen before? What do I want to see on screen? And, you know, the idea of him like unsheathing a tree to use it as like a bat sword was like, I just loved the idea of him stripping a tree like that. And I wanted to put in imagery, and I wanted to put in a thinking process and a thought process that would help future-proof him in future movies, because if he's going to take on Godzilla, who's going to be enormous, like, he's really got to have an ingenuity to him. Mm-hmm. So I loved the idea of seeing him use tools and improvise, and he totally is a brawler, but his fighting style honestly has more to do this was a big thing and, you know, it was about a year into the process with Industrial Light and Magicor geniuses who designed my childhood, and it's an honor to work with those guys, and they're amazing. But Jeff White, who is our visual effects supervisor, turned to me and he's like, you know, we're about a year in and I think we finally figured out your like aesthetic style. Just because the way that he would normally move, or the way that a creature of that size should move, is not how he moves in the movie. The way he moves in the film is a way more hyper-stylized, like, kinetic thing that has more to do with, like, the way the mechs move in Evangelion or in anime than, like, a big creature of that size. Like, there was a lot of Evangelion references in the film, but particularly, like, just that very, like, manga, like, hyper-stylized, very fast brawling. Like, to me, that was a huge thing, because, like, getting that animation right and not having to move in the simian way, and getting that like that potency and that power and that kind of like visceral rawness to it, as opposed to these slow lumbering, you know, things punching each other, it was a huge thing, kind of like breaking that through and getting that right.
Yeah, I'm also fascinated by some of the other monsters on this island. I mean, the creature design must have been a fun job to do. Was there a lot of discarded ideas that never made it to screen?
There were thousands and thousands and thousands of creature designs that never made it to screen, because very early on I was like, well, I don't want to do dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Peter did dinosaurs really well. Jurassic World, the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are recent in our memory. And to me, as like a genre nerd and as like a movie monster nerd and a creature feature nerd, like what an incredible opportunity to design these things from the ground up. So, you know, we would show people sketches or I'd show friends sketches. Do you feel like you've seen this before? Do you feel like you've seen this before? And there's this period where we were getting pretty far on the Kong design and we were getting pretty far with a lot of the production design, but there was still this huge hole of like, you know, the concept art and the imagery drove the script in every way. In every way. Like, we were always ahead of the script, and so the script was always having to catch up to us to say, here's this creature, so we're designing a set piece around this. Here's this creature, so we need to put this in here. You know, sometimes writers would try and write, like, oh, it's this cool thing, but, like, never once did any of those things of, like, I think someone writing a weird creature, like, ever make it in the movie, because the concept art and the designs that we were doing was always leading the script. And that's a testament to like how incredible the concept artists and people that I was working with are, you know. And so if you're designing things from the ground up, it took a long time before we stumbled upon what I sort of have referred to, and it's out there, sort of this like Miyazaki element. Mm. You know, like the water buffalo is the one that sort of broke it open initially, where it felt like it had a mythic quality, and the myth is such a big part of this movie to me, and it had this mythic quality where it had a spirituality to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it had this sense of if Kong is the god of the island, then these creatures are the gods of their individual domains. And so having all these creatures have like a majesty and a beauty, like I almost would think about them like if Terrence Malick shot a monster movie, like would this creature look beautiful in it?
Yeah.
You know, and so that the buffalo kind of was the thing that broke it open, that became this guiding force for that.
Yeah, I think the giant stick insects, there's something quite sort of fairy tale and magical about them in a also, you know, morbidly dangerous way as well.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things where, well, that's also like a very like weird pacifist moment where it's like, oh, like you shoot this thing, it scared the shit out of you, and then very quickly you're like, oh, I'm so sorry. I did that. And then he dies, you know. And he dies because, not because, but you know, it says something that the guy who shot first, you know, and foolishly sort of reacted that way, you know, is killed.
Yeah.
And there's just something I just loved, that sort of weird, like the water buffalo too, that scene like is totally about some weird pacifism in terms of like, yeah, thinking and not assuming everything is bad and not assuming that everything wants to kill you, and you know, Slivko putting his gun down and Weaver bringing her camera up.
And I mean, as you say, there is, you know, it is more than just a monster movie you're going for. I mean, there's a clear sort of allegory for Vietnam here, but there's also like an environmental element to that. Was this a sort of element from the start in the sort of earliest drafts of the scripts?
Yeah, well, I just really felt like it was unfair to play with the imagery of things like Apocalypse Now or the Vietnam War and not say something, you know, like I didn't think that it was an appropriate thing to just like pillage that imagery and not have a message associated with it. And so for me, like the allegory of the war was always necessary, and I'm actually like psyched how much of that made it in, because there were conversations at first that were like, you guys can't say anything about the war. And I was like, no, we're not going to make a movie about Vietnam and then not say something about the war. And it's not like we're like breaking new ground with it, but I think it was necessary. And the, you know, the environmental stuff like very much plays off of the thematics of things like Mononoke and man's relationship with nature and man's relationship with gods and man's relationship with the unknown, and being okay with the unknown, you know, and being, mm-hmm, and like being reconfronted with myth and things greater than us, and not having that freak us out, but being okay with it.
Yeah. And it's got such a strong sort of distinct visual style and aesthetic to it. Is there a shot that you're most proud of, or that is a sort of personal favorite of yours?
There's a lot that I'm pretty proud of. You know, I had an incredible DP, Larry Fong, with me. But, you know, I think if anyone saw Kings of Summer, my last movie, and then saw this, they'd actually, like, see a lot of connections between them in terms of the way it's shot. But, you know, suddenly you have a big budget and you can do all these crazy things. Like, Kong's reveal, like those sunset shots where he's silhouetted, like, I'm really, really proud of those. I think those are really striking. And I think, like, just can sit on the mantle of, like, monster reveals in movies and Kong reveals. There's just a lot of like weird, like strange imagery that I'm like, odd. Like all the stuff with the gas mask, you know, they were trying to cut that forever. They were like, why? Why does he have a gas mask? Why is he in smoke? What? And it's like, it looks cool. and well, it's not just that. It honestly, like, the moment totally made sense to me. And then there was like, it's honestly like a divisive moment. Some people will watch me like, that's stupid.
Yeah.
That's way too stylized. That's stupid. And the moment for me that really sealed it was when we were doing a test screen and there were two like 9-year-old kids in front of me. And that moment came on where Tom Hiddleston has the gas mask and he's in the green smoke slicing the birds.
Yeah.
And the two 9-year-old kids just turned to each other and their jaw, like in unison, and their jaw dropped. And then they looked back at the screen and you could just tell how happy it made them. And so to me at that moment, it was just like unequivocally something that had to stay in the movie.
Yeah. I did wonder, this sort of leads me on to, there's a lot of references to other media, let's say, throughout the film. Is the samurai sword, I mean, it's, you know, it's John C. Reilly's characters originally. Is that a reference to Step Brothers by any chance?
You know, I've never told John this, but I've never seen Step Brothers.
You've never seen Step Brothers?
No.
Okay, so it's not a reference then.
No, that's a reference to me loving Asian culture.
Okay.
And being obsessed with samurai.
Yeah.
And there actually is a Mononoke reference built into that sword.
Okay.
No, that's not a Step Brothers okay. thing.
I was reaching a bit too far there, maybe. I did definitely spot an obvious one for the Jurassic Park where Samuel L. Jackson says, hold on to your butts. Because I love some of the nerdier ones. What's
if you want to get really nitty gritty, yeah. Okay, so there's one that I'm not going to say because I'm really curious how long it's going to take for people to find it. You know, I'm just going to... There's a very explicit Taxi Driver reference that no one's brought
okay.
up yet. The patch that John C. Reilly wears on his jacket, it says Lizard Company.
Okay.
Travis Bickle wore a patch that said King Kong Company.
Okay.
And no one's brought that up, and it's in the trailers, and I think that's really funny.
I did notice the For Your Health on the back, the Steve Brule reference.
Well, it's Steve Brule, but it's also Akira. It's a funny... the Akira jacket says good for your health,
okay.
bad for education on it. And so it happened to align with, it's funny.
Double reference.
More people associated with Steve Brule yeah. than Akira, which is it makes sort of amazing and odd to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's definitely an Akira reference. There is, God, I mean, there's an alien reference in the movie, like a very specific one. There's a, honestly, like this movie is just so chock filled with. Honestly, one day I want to just like put a list online,
yeah,
and be like, find all these references, and then yeah. see what people come back with, you know, and see if they can find them all. Then I'll give them like one of the samurai swords or something from the movie.
On Hot Fuzz, Edgar Wright put a commentary track or a subtitle track where he just put a subtitle for every reference in the movie.
Oh, like, that's
every movie reference. So perhaps that's something for the Blu-ray.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that. That's actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'll get into it in the, like, I'm sure on the Blu-ray I'll be like, that's this, that's that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's hard to like listen to this and not have the visual with it. But
sure.
There's so many weird references like
is
that.
Is it just a, is it just like a nod to
there's
your
a huge
fellow...
Metal Gear reference, you know, the boat.
Right.
The boat's called the Grey
Fox. Yes, yeah.
I'm very excited for Kojima to watch it.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a little bit about Monarch, which is obviously like, it's the connective tissue between your film and Godzilla and then the rest of the,
right.
the monsters verse. Have you hashed out like a backstory for Monarch? What exactly is it? Sort of extra governmental?
Yeah, there's a bunch of like internal legendary documents that sort of detail what Monarch is to some degree. But, you know, we were really trying to tell the best story for our movie. So, you know, and that's actually why the end credits tag got taken off for a second, because they were worried that the like the space they were in and the like the facility that was being designed didn't like jive with what Monarch was. You know, because they've got a lot of that Monarch stuff sort of plotted out, what it was, when it was developed, you know, and this movie sheds a little bit more light on that. But you're going to see, I think, much, much more of that in Godzilla too.
Yeah. And I guess just on the future of the monsters verse, are you party to any of that at all? Has there been any discussions about your
involvement? I've seen some really cool concept art and some really cool previs for Godzilla 2 that people should be pretty excited about. But no, as of right now, like I'm not a part of. I've not been asked to be a part of a think tank or anything like that. I think that they're kind of getting through Godzilla 2, and I know that they're like starting to write the script on Kong versus Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, I kind of keep joking that the movie that I'm actually most interested in seeing is a prequel to this. It's just John C. Reilly like fighting monsters with a katana, and like what his relationship with Gunpei, the Japanese pilot, is, and what his relationship to like the Iwi, the villagers, are.
Right.
Like that like make like a $30 million version of that. That's like weird and funny and like kind of this weird, you know, in like a Looper District 9 sense. Like that's the movie that I'm actually most interested in making.
Okay. Well, that could be interesting. What about, I mean, there's been no director announced for Godzilla versus Kong. Is that something you would be interested in, do you think?
I have a lot of love for both those characters. I would much rather make the prequel that I just talked about, or like, I don't see how that fits into my life necessarily, because if I'm going to go take on a giant big movie, like Metal Gear Solid would be the movie that I would much rather sort of throw my attention towards because of my love for that property. So, you know, I've played with monsters and I've played with Kong, and I guess you could technically say like I've played with Godzilla just because of our end tag. You know, I never say never, but we'll see.
Okay. Jordan, thank you so much for your time.
Dude, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, so that was Jordan Voigt Roberts. And before we get into the nitty gritty of the movie and talk about spoilers and whatnot, that's just general reaction to the movie. What's your take on it, Nick, as someone who was practically in the movie? I believe you did some mocap on Kong.
I was a skull crawler. They were modelled on me. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I had fun with it. You know, it's a kind of quasi follow up to Godzilla, the legendary Godzilla, which I thought was a little bit on the dull side. It looked amazing, but a little bit boring. And I thought that they brought the fun here. It's not a perfect film. It definitely has flaws, but it's got a giant monkey, and it really is a giant monkey this time, twatting helicopters.
No, it's an ape. They would want me to make that clear, I feel like. Isn't it?
Well, then you many of my puns that. In the future, I think I have to get back and rewrite. But yeah, I had fun with it. I think it has, you know, it does have problems. There are way too many characters, for one. Way too many. It's like five films worth of characters. And for a film that kind of follows aliens, the model I think is aliens in a way, obviously Apocalypse Now to an extent. Hmm. But Aliens does a great job of giving every character depth and something to do. This doesn't really pull that off. But the visuals are great.
I agree, actually, with that. I think that the so we saw this a few weeks ago now, and I just at the weekend I saw the trailer again, and it reminded me how great it looks and how great the monsters are and how great some of those fight scenes are. They're absolutely astonishing. But for me, that was what was missing, was a little bit more of the human drama. I feel like they had an incredible cast, like just chocker with incredibly talented actors, and I wanted them all to have more to do. And I think I sort of said this in the main podcast, but I think this is why Peter Jackson made that decision to make his Kong 3 hours long. It may have felt too long, but it did give him that time to build up the human characters and still have all this space to let the beasts strut their stuff. And so I'm not saying it should have been 3 hours long. I'm really, really not. But I would have sacrificed a couple of action scenes, I think, to have, or certainly, as you say, about 10 characters to have a little bit more focus on the ones that remain.
You could have lost 10 or 20, maybe 30. Still would have worked.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's too many characters. I think it's already too long, this movie, in fairness. It doesn't quite do what I wanted it to do. If you follow the Aliens template, the thing about Aliens is that an alien doesn't appear in Aliens until an hour in, even though you know it's coming, and it builds up the tension in a masterful way. And this movie, I thought, it blew its Kong load far too quickly for me.
Wow.
I agree with that. Image.
I agree with that entirely. If you have a monster movie, you know, Jurassic Park does it brilliantly. Jackson's King Kong does it brilliantly. Mm. That slow build up to the reveal. Mm. And I think if you have the prologue as kind of cool as that idea is, you're giving a lot away, including what the island looks like.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, the Jackson one, they're approaching the island of the ship, and there's that sense of dread and what are we going to find? Mm. And they have that in this movie with the storm, but you've already kind of seen what the island looks like, so that doesn't really work.
Yeah, I think the idea of the prologue, I enjoyed the prologue. I'm not as up in the movie as you guys are. That may become abundantly clear. I call the movie Wrong Dull Island.
But
that's just an obvious pun. So
it calls you piss poo
it. It doesn't not.
It does. It told me.
Does it?
No.
Oh my god.
It's a film. Can't talk.
Piss poo it.
I'm so sorry, Chris.
I'm having such a flashback right now.
No, ew.
No, not to this morning, but to my childhood. Because that was kind of my nickname. Anyway, so this movie I thought wasn't satisfying on many levels. I thought, but the idea of the Prague is pretty cool, and if they just held back on showing the monster right away, on showing Kong right away, who knows, that might have.
It's a weird one because obviously they show Kong, even with the Jackson one, they show Kong heavily in the marketing. We had Jackson's King Kong on the cover, and so you already kind of know what it's like. But once you get into the cinema, I think there is a positive to having that slow build up.
Yeah. What did you think about Kong's design? Because it took me a little bit of time to get used to. Now, I know it's close to the 1933 original, that just something about the head shape. But I actually really like the more gorilla look of Jackson's Kong. And so it actually took me quite a while to get used to this Kong. I was like, oh, he's too upright. He's too sort of human in his movement. It really took me a good 20 minutes, half an hour to even sort of accept that this was Kong in a weird way.
Yeah, he walks around like a person, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he does.
Just sort of strolling around. I think one of the first shots of him walking around on the island, like the full body shot, sort of pans up his ass for quite a long time, which was a bit disconcerting. But I think he looks good. And I think it's interesting. I believe that Toby Kebbell did the face work Terry Notary did the body.
That seems to be what
which is interesting that
the
they've
line is, yeah.
divided. I wonder where the exact... I wonder who did the neck. But I thought it worked. I liked this Kong. He had some soul.
Mm.
And he was pretty badass.
Yeah, he really was. Like, he's enormous. Like, that is something we should talk about. He's by far the biggest Kong.
Well, that's because they know where they're going with this.
Yes.
And they know that they're going towards, well, maybe going towards, depending on box office and whatnot, Godzilla versus Kong, so ultimately.
Can we talk about this post-credit sting and this whole joined up thing?
We certainly can.
Because, the Monarch verse.
Yeah. The Monarch verse.
Yeah,
I didn't like this post-credit sting. It's a very knowing film. And the thing about, just going back to my point about the prologue and Foyt Roberts' decision to show Kong, I mean, he shows Kong from the off, and then he shows him again very early in the film.
Yeah.
And I think a part of that might be a reaction to, or maybe a comment on, the fact that so many movie news websites now exist. No movie exists in a vacuum. People are falling over themselves to get spoiler images to reveal what things look like. So he probably knew going in we would know what Kong looked like. So why not just show him in the first few minutes of the film? Why not? And I think also the post-credit sting is a bit of a comment on post-credit stings itself. Not in its overall terribleness, but the beginning with Hiddleston saying, you know, I know you're there. I've only seen this film once, so I'm paraphrasing wildly. I can see you in the dark. You're watching this. You're enjoying it, aren't you? And it's like, don't leave.
That was pretty
I genuinely thought he might be in the projection booth. I was going, what is happening? This is meta.
But it's another. The problem with that I had was so presumably we're tying up these two films now. We're presumably not tying up the human characters, right? Because Godzilla was present day.
Yeah.
We're assuming everybody seemed to be shocked by Godzilla's appearance. It wasn't like, oh, it's this dude again. Like, it wasn't like, oh, we've seen him. We know what this is. Mm. So presumably, one would expect Godzilla v. Kong to take place after Godzilla, unless they've done a really world-level cover-up. So none of the human characters, presumably, can return without 40 years of aging makeup.
That would be amazing. That's what I think is going to happen. It's going to be Tom Hiddleston and Brie Larson doing a Peggy Carter and just hobbling around with like liver spots and no hair.
Yeah,
that would be interesting.
It seems I get that you want to give your filmmaker the chance to make the film that they want to make, and I think that's commendable. That's something that we talked about with James Mangold just recently, but at the same time, if you are intentionally building this as the second in a continuing shared universe of monsters, don't you have to think about that? And does that mean that these human characters were always, you know, intended to be one film use only, and that there's no carryover?
It was actually originally set even earlier. I can't remember the. I think it was originally set in the 1930s still, until Jordan came on board pushed it to the 70s. So it was never in the present day.
Right. If you remember, were you at Comic-Con when this project was first announced?
I was, yeah.
So if you remember, there was a teaser at Comic-Con that basically just showed lush vegetation and showed things around the island and had a very portentous voiceover by a posh Brit. So clearly they had Hiddleston on their mind.
Don't we all?
Talking about how dangerous this place was, and then it reveals at the end. It was just called Skull Island back then.
Mm.
So I think the idea might have been just to have Kong at the end of the movie, who knows. But clearly they were going for, that seemed to me to be 1930s or even earlier, just the vernacular that he was using, the character in the yeah. voiceover was using very almost Victorian phrases,
right?
So I'm intrigued by this decision to not join the films up, and I do wonder though if the one and done is part of the reason why it appealed to people like Hiddleston and Sam Jackson, who have had multiple film contracts in their in their present.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't always want to sign on for the three film deal.
Maybe that's true, but I think it is symptomatic of what we're talking about, which is this focus on monsters rather than people. And I think, and I get that it's a monster movie, I really do, but I feel like you always need to have the human heart in there, and I've been writing about another film recently, as Nick knows, because he commissioned me, and everyone in regard to that film is saying just that. You need to have a human story as well as having, you know, big scary monsters.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get onto the humans in a minute, but I mean, what do we think of the 70s setting, like, in general? I kind of thought I had fun with it.
I thought it was cool, I thought the whole Vietnam parallels were really, like, visually gorgeous and very cool, and perhaps a little bit perhaps a little bit of a change from the way that Vietnam seems to be treated, generally speaking, in American cinema, which is it's taken very seriously because it is still, you know,
and regretful.
So it was a bit of a shock to the system that way, because it didn't quite have that tone about it. There were elements of it, certainly, with, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's kind of war addicted figure, and, you know, Toby Kebbell's character just desperate to get home already and be done with all of this. You know, there were traces of it, but it tonally, that it was sometimes odd, but visually it was brilliant.
Yeah. It felt like you had two Kurtzes in the film, almost. Like, Kong had a bit of a Brando vibe going on, and obviously Packard, Samuel L. Jackson. But yeah, I read someone point out that it's a metaphorical Vietnam film and a literal one. It's like there's a lot of Nam going on there. But the helicopter scene alone, I think,
was cool.
Made it worthwhile. I really enjoyed that scene. I think that was the best.
And the music was good. The music was good.
I do wonder, though, because they're playing Final Records on a helicopter.
And you're worried about scratching.
The amount of skipping.
That's true.
Alone. It's going to be almost unlistenable.
Yeah.
That took me right out of the movie.
That was unrealistic. That was the only unrealistic factor.
And then the giant 100-foot ape, no problem.
No problem.
Hang on.
He took me back into
that
the movie.
That record isn't scratching.
Now we're on safe ground. It's all good. I agree with a lot of what you say. Can I go full partridge? Can I shock you? I'm not a big King Kong fan. And I realise that this is probably sacrilege, and I know there are people out there, not necessarily in this booth, but film fans out there who adore the original King Kong movie and
the 70s one. I've never met anyone who likes the 70s one.
Nobody likes the 70s
one. The Jeff Bridges one, which means that the Big Lebowski, the dude and Walter...
Yeah.
Are both in a King Kong film now, which is an amazing fact.
Okay, so we need
Buscemi
in the Godzilla versus Kong.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I think we can make this happen.
I do love that you know, John Goodman, that obviously his character in Big Lebowski is banging on about Vietnam constantly, and that you were there. And I just love that he's now in a Vietnam film, and it's this one.
I'm sure he's equally overjoyed.
He made a joke on the set that he spent most of his early life trying to avoid Vietnam, and then he ended up shooting there. But that was like his first time there.
Huh? Market zero, dude. But I'm not a huge King Kong fan. I really don't love the original movie.
Get out.
I didn't love the Peter Jackson film. I think there's some really great, the Kong Ferex fight, and that is one for the ages. But the rest of it is about 2 hours too long.
I really liked it, and I know that that's not a cool opinion, generally
speaking.
The Jackson one,
Oh, I love the Jackson one. I honestly love it. I can watch that over and over again.
It's beautifully put together. I mean, some of the work in that is just stunning. Kong against the sunset and all that kind of stuff.
It's got so much heart as well.
So much heart, and you know, they give it room to breathe. They give Kong so much sort of character development as a as a character in his own right, as a person in his own right, and I sort of adored that, and I was heartbroken by the time we got to New York. Absolutely heartbroken.
And it's got beautiful little, you know, obviously we're not going to turn this into a podcast about that film. There's the beautiful little moments like near the end where Kong has killed one of the dinosaurs and he just sort of starts playing with the jawbone.
Yeah.
And it's such a nice little character beat that you don't need, it's not essential, but little moments like that. Mm. And I thought this was maybe missing a little bit of that personality.
Yeah, I didn't get to know Kong or engage with Kong in this one. So then you have to have the human characters take up the slack. And I think for me, two of the human characters really stood out, and perhaps unexpectedly so. One is Shea Whigham's character, Cole, I believe is his name, who I thought was the only one of the grunts who really had something about him. I thought he was very, very interesting, and I kind of felt really bad when he was denied the heroic death that he was trying to line up for himself. I know it's a joke in the movie that you think this is going to be the way he goes out, and then he just gets flung against the wall as an afterthought and then explodes.
It's the way I want to go.
It's the way we should all go. And I really enjoyed John C. Reilly and the multiple movies he was in this film.
Yeah, he was in a different movie,
This is kind of interesting, because, all right, so on my second set visit, I went to Australia and the Gold Coast, and I got to see John C. Reilly's one of his big days, and he was doing the monologue where he's in the Iwi Temple, and he's talking about, you know, we're on Kong's island, and you know, we're making enemies of him. And it was really interesting watching them shoot that, because they were going through so many modulations. Some of them were pure comedy and some of them were really serious, and they obviously were just leaving themselves so much room to figure out the character. And they didn't quite, John C. Reilly didn't quite know where he was meant to be going with it. But they obviously went, I mean, you can kind of see that in the film. There's a bit of inconsistency scene to scene.
Is he tragic or comic or tragicomic? Yeah, you can't quite figure it out.
But he is he's fun to watch for the most part. I do have thoughts about that, the way the film ends on him. I'm not sure that was necessarily the right way to end.
Because he becomes the emotional heart of the film in a way that you just don't expect.
Yeah.
Because as good as they are in the film, the likes of Hiddleston and Brie Larson and Sam Jackson and John Goodman, who I think is completely wasted in this film after a really interesting start.
I watched him die. I saw two actors die on set.
Who was the other one?
The other one was John Ortiz in Vietnam. He gets yanked off the boat, I believe.
Mm. Yes, he does.
He's got the briefcase, hasn't he? Yeah, I saw him being a stunt Ortiz being yanked out of the boat, like way up in the air, which was pretty cool.
Wow.
But yeah, that was good.
Because I don't think the other characters, the main characters, necessarily have the gravitas or the backstory to really make us care for them.
They just needed some more time. Even one more scene with Larson and Hiddleston, I think, would have helped enormously, because they kind of do try to set them up. They try to set up, oh, look, he's this sort of maverick former SAS guy. He's very cynical. He's kind of not quite gone native, but he's gone off the grid a little bit. And then and he's the guy who will help us out and figure this out and get us through this jungle. And then that isn't really what he gets a chance to do. Not really. And then Brie Larson, oh, she's a war photographer. We're not sure about her. Maybe she's anti-war. But that's it. There's no attempt to maybe help her.
And it's a classified mission. Why is there a photographer on this classified mission?
So is she with them or against them? Are they worried about that? Is she under orders to do some things and not other things? Yeah. How did that get set up?
And there was points where she would see this giant water buffalo creature that never exists anywhere else, and she takes one photo of it. That annoyed me slightly. It's like, maybe, get coverage, you know.
Maybe she lost a bunch of her spare films in the crash, I guess.
Maybe,
that was really Miyazaki, that moment, though. It was a beautiful moment. It
actually was, because Jordan said that moment was inspired by his love of Miyazaki. And I mean, he's super geeky in the best possible way. Mm. And so there's references to video games. There's a Metal Gear Solid reference in there, and all tons of little nods and stuff.
Yeah. In fact, isn't John C. Reilly's jacket is a Steve Brule quote, isn't it?
Something like For Your Health, which is like a reference to Steve Brule, who's obviously his Adult Swim, Tim and Eric kind of character. But going back to Conrad, my thought about Conrad is you've got this character who is an amazing retired SAS tracker, but you don't introduce him doing anything that it just seems like screenwriting 101. Introduce this guy doing some tracking, because he does very little tracking in this film.
Yeah.
And the bar fight, you know, he looks cool, but I don't know. I just imagined a scene where
Do you think they were going for sort of cantina, a Mos Eisley cantina kind of intro?
Yeah, it felt a bit like a Steven Seagal intro to me.
Ooh, damning.
No, I mean only on Deadly Ground and all these Seagal movies. You introduce his character, you know, in playing pool and beating up a load of guys in a park. It felt fairly first base.
Yeah.
And I just thought, have the guy in a jungle and then have the helicopter land and you know, some people brief him on a mission he has to go on. Something like that. Because he doesn't do a lot of tracking, really.
That's true. And I did have a bit of an issue with the fact that... So it's basically, once they crash land on the island, it's about finding each other and finding the north corner where they might be picked up, although it's not quite clear how, because they have no helicopters anymore, but that's fine. But because there gets to be a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing, so you lose that sense of geography and you lose that sense of forward momentum to get to a place by a time. So it's like, if it's difficult to get across the island, you don't double back. But even if Samuel L. Jackson tells you to, you know, you don't go off west whatever, if you know you need to get north.
You do whatever Samuel L. Jackson
maybe
tells
you
to
do. Yeah, I got a bit good enough for the Avengers.
Got a bit confused by what Toby Kebbell was up to in the middle. Sort of cut to Toby Kebbell. I was like, what? I forgot he was in the film.
At one point, I thought they were going to do a really dark joke with Toby Kebbell, that, you know, he would be spend the entire movie fending off threats, and then they would get to him at the end of the movie, and then he would be eaten. But they just kind of lost interest in that story. It seemed to me, anyway, that he has that really, and I did like the sequence, because if you think about it, he has that moment where he's crouching in the water, and then Kong appears and fights the giant octopus thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it does. So basically, it's Toby Kebbell playing a scene with himself, ish, which is really interesting.
I think Robbie Collin described that as Kong's old boy moment. Which was very nice.
But that was a decent sequence, and that character had potential to show someone who's utterly shit scared and being bombarded by things that can kill you.
Mm.
And then he meets one of the Skullcrawlers and just gets killed, and you're okay, what's the point of
it? It felt like he was built up too much to just get killed, but too little to... Yeah. For you to really be devastated by it.
And frankly, Toby Kebbell is a really good actor, and I'm fed up with him being wasted in movies like this and Fantastic Four and Ben-Hur, and he deserves better, Dynamite.
Yeah. Mm.
Why not have Conrad get stuck on his own and have him coming back to the group or something? I just think if you see the journey through one character's eyes, it's a lot more effective than jumping around and you're not really getting to know who anyone is. But I did love the log monster, the stick insect monster.
Yeah.
The log insect monster.
The log insect monster was really good. I like the sort of giant spider thing that was
a great scene.
Spike to the guys.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that this morning.
Yeah.
I saw a spider and flashback to that.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing you do not want to see.
That was your NAMM flashback.
That was I'm gonna be waking up sweating in the night thinking about that scene, but that's a good scene.
It was, yeah.
But it's an interesting point as well about the film's attitude towards US military and perhaps the US policy of shoot first, ask questions later.
Mm.
I mean, they when they get to the island,
napalm first
and ask questions later, and they shoot everything that they come across. Pretty much, they say
it's
even
odd.
The stick insect monster gets shot. I mean, what's going on?
It really. I mean, maybe this is a valid scientific method from the 1970s, and this is something that really happened. But it did seem odd to me that purportedly scientific expedition would napalm first and ask questions. It's an entirely undiscovered world. They're talking about how it might have, for example, significant oil reserves or mineral reserves. And I don't know, napalm and oil don't seem to go that brilliantly together to me. So,
I think technically those were the things they're dropping are like seismic charges. Rather than napalm. I don't think they napalm anything.
They're trying to
uh-huh.
But they're certainly blowing stuff up.
They're blowing shit up.
And there's poor deer running. I mean, I was talking to Ollie Gibbs on our art desk yesterday about what a terrible year deer are having at the cinema.
That is true.
We've made a list of films in which deer get either hit by a car or shot, and it's
we're
in early March, and it's Cure for Wellness, L, Split, Get Out, Lost City of Z, and this. Although you don't see a deer get killed in this, but
yeah, I mean they're pretty
pull
much
one out for the deer.
Yeah,
they're having a shocker.
Pull one out for the deer. I will toast the deer tonight with my venison dinner. Of course,
oh,
I won't.
Christ, you monster.
I won't. Of course, I won't. Tasty deer. But it's interesting because I think one of the film's most intriguing threads, and it doesn't really follow through in this, is the John Goodman character, because the John Goodman character is behind the expedition, and you kind of know from the author it's going to be something a little bit more to him, but I don't think it quite followed through with that.
He's kind of the Carter Burke.
Yeah, he drops the seismic charges. He knows there's something on the thing. He has that interesting kind of sub-quint speech about, I was on a ship and I got attacked by something and I know the monsters are out there and you don't know, man. You weren't there. You didn't see. and I just feel that ultimately the movie loses track of him again. So by the time he's in the graveyard, the boneyard, the bone graveyard, it's where bones go to die, a bone graveyard, that... he gets killed almost as an afterthought, and you're thinking, no, there's something interesting about
this
character.
You kind of want him at the end of the film, don't you? Yeah. And you want that moment where people turn on him, and quite a good death, though. It's not a bad death. The camera.
The whole bone scene was pretty cool,
going off.
Yeah, it was quite tense.
That was one of the better elements of the film, is the deaths. I thought they were quite imaginative for the most part. Mm. But I mean, what do we think about them shooting on location? Because that was their big selling point for this film.
They went
to Vietnam, which no Hollywood film has ever shot there, and went right into the jungle.
I mean, it looked stunning. I think in terms of just purely the locations, I think it looked absolutely incredible. I mean, that paid off, no question for me. And I couldn't sort of see the joins between the three continents, if you like.
Well,
they
actually sort of jigsawed. I think they described it as jigsawing the three continents together using CG. So there are shots where there is landscape from
awesome.
And these big karst cliffs, jagged cliffs from Vietnam. They added to like the Hawaii scenery and stuff. So it's pretty clever what they've done.
It really is. I think that part of it worked really, really well. No question about that as well. What did you think about the natives on Skull Island?
Yeah. Not great. I kind of didn't really get why they were there even. Mm. I mean, they're an essential part of kind of the King Kong story. Peter Jackson got some flack, I remember, for how he portrayed the natives, the tribespeople, as being quite terrifying and quite scary. And obviously these ones are a lot more placid. But they didn't really do anything.
No. And they're maybe psychic, and that was weird.
Yeah. Yeah. They had cool makeup.
They did have incredibly cool makeup, yeah. All of those sort of tattoos.
And they had a cool gait. I remember they had a pretty cool gait.
They seem to know an awful lot about the creatures on the island, which is... you know, they seem to live behind a giant wall, kept them away from... But then I guess you would know over the years after you've been killed. I just wonder, how did they get there? What's the story?
Yeah, who knows? But I mean... Moana gave them a lift. I thought they could have been more proactive. They could have joined in that final battle and helped out against the Skull Crawlers, or just had something to do. I just thought they set up all these characters. Mm. And then, didn't really sort of pay off, I don't think.
So where do we think it's going to go? Do we think it is going to go? I mean, tracking so far for the box office, we'll know by the time you're listening to this podcast, you'll know how it did. But I don't know if this one's going to make... huge amount of money at the box office. Probably wrong.
Well, that third incredibly spoilerific trailer was pretty spectacular looking, if you don't mind the entire film being given away.
The marketing's been really good, I think.
Marketing's been really strong.
Absolutely.
I think it's going to do very solid business, I would expect.
The posters are amazing. The poster campaign. If you haven't seen all the posters, go on and have a look at them. They're incredible.
And in terms of where it goes, it is interesting, isn't it? I don't know. So this Kong is about... You can... set me right on this, Nick, about 100 feet tall, a bit more.
Oh gosh, let's go with that.
Okay, and the Godzilla was more like 300
feet tall. Yeah.
So a straight up fight between the two of them, you know, Godzilla has the advantage.
Who's to say though that Kong is not a baby at this point in
and
time
and has another 40 years
because
to grow?
Remember you see the parents in the boneyard, and who's to say that this Kong is not going to double in size in between the two movies?
That is also possible, although his parents' skulls didn't look that much bigger than his.
Good point.
But maybe, you know,
they were babies.
Increasing radiation in the whatever over the years.
Absolutely.
Blah, 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 you know?
Yep.
Listen, children can be bigger than their parents.
That is
and they can
true.
Just suddenly have a growth spurt. I've got a friend who's 6'5", his dad was only 5'11". It can happen.
Kong could be the Stephen Merchant of giant apes.
He could be.
Does this mean Godzilla is the Ricky Gervais or the Carl Pilate?
But presumably, what we're sort of expecting, right, is going to be some kind of team up rather than a straight up versus, right?
Isn't the film Godzilla versus Kong? Isn't that the name of the film at the moment?
Yeah, but it was Batman versus Superman, but they still teamed up at the end. Spoiler.
Oh, what? yes, because obviously they've revealed at the end of the movie that there are other monsters out there. There's Mumra,
Mothra,
and Jegwin, and
Rodan.
Okay, Jegwin. Yeah.
No. King Ghidorah.
300 foot tall Keith Jegwin.
Well, I'd run.
But from the naked jungle, that Keith Jegwin, so everything's out?
No.
Gosh,
that's a villain Godzilla couldn't face.
You've got me thinking now. At the end of that film, I've got Godzilla and Kong going to find they've got something in common.
But how do they find they've got something in common?
They can't speak.
Maybe they can. Maybe they'll understand that, it means Martha.
Your mom is Martha. My mom is Martha. Oh, my God.
Why'd you say that name?
Yeah, presumably, I mean, one of those many other beasts that we see at the end of this film could unite them to whatever. Kong presumably is more agile than Godzilla, faster moving potentially.
Mm-hmm. He can pick things up.
He has opposable thumbs.
He's got a great move where he pulls a tree out the ground and then strips it and then uses it as like a kind of tree lance.
Well, that's true. I mean, gorillas do use tools.
Yeah. And he can also fling poo. That's not beating around the bush here. It's a tried and tested, time-honored ape tradition. If he sees Godzilla turn shit up, he will tear shit up. So look forward to that. So it's literally on the IMDb at the moment. You click on trivia, and it says, "Yeah, there's a post-credit scene with those three beasts at the end. Who are? What are their names? Mothra." Showing my lack of knowledge.
I think you also saw Rodan and King Ghidorah.
Okay,
if I remember
so
right.
They're saving Chegwin for the.
They're saving Chegwin. Yeah, they're holding him back. They've got a
massive,
back.
Massive Cheggers.
Got to hold back your Cheggers.
Yeah, you got to keep it. So that's exciting. Sam Jackson, just very quickly, just
solid. Very solid.
Really solid. I thought he did the best job of making something of what he was given.
I think he was on the wavelength. I think he more than anyone else was on the wavelength of the kind of movie that this is. He was fun. It was kind of a bit cartoonish, but it kind of, for me, you know, we've seen him do that kind of stuff before. It wasn't massively groundbreaking for him, but I thought Packard was fun. Yeah. And the scene where he has the stare off with Kong is just great. I mean, who doesn't want to see Samuel L. Jackson in a stare off with, I can't remember who wins that contest.
It's still going on.
Yeah.
It's
someone's got to edit that into a YouTube video where they're just staring at each other for an hour.
I enjoyed. I thought the Descent Psychosis was a little bit pat, but I enjoyed his final showdown with Kong, where he, even when he sees that Kong is a force for good, he still decides to try and kill him anyway, and then Kong basically just squashes him flat like a bug with a super fast reflexes.
He quotes a line from Jurassic Park. Did you spot
No,
that?
I didn't.
Yeah, hold on to your butts, he says as he flies in the helicopter.
Amazing,
really.
So that's pretty cool.
That's cool.
Obviously, he was meant to film Jurassic Park in the same place in Hawaii where they filmed this, but then he didn't.
Okay,
there is more of an anecdote there. I just decided not to tell it.
It says here
he was
going to
be. All right, well, look, Samuel L. Jackson was going to be killed by a raptor. He does get killed by a raptor, but you were going to actually see him being killed by the raptor. But then the hurricane swept in and destroyed the set,
so he couldn't
shoot his death scene.
So much better. Spielberg has really good luck with that sort of stuff. You know, the sword fight with the Arab swordsman and Raiders would not have been as good as what happened if Harrison Ford hadn't got the shits. So this is a good thing.
This is not
ultimately.
Luck. That's not luck. That's Spielberg being awesome.
Spielberg, what are you implying here? That he spiked Harrison Ford's water than like
four?
No,
I'm just saying that, you know, when adversity comes at him,
he thinks
rises.
On his feet.
Yeah.
He rises to meet the challenge.
Yeah.
All right, okay. And there we go. That's our Kong Skull Island spoiler special, ending with a eulogy by Steven Spielberg, just as it should be. Join us every Friday, of course, for our regular Empire podcast. If you don't already listen to those, then please do. In terms of spoiler specials, our Logan spoiler special with director James Mangold is out now. It's 2 hours long, but hopefully worth it. And our next spoiler special, I think, is going to be Ben Wheatley's Free Fire.
Ooh.
I think, with the director himself talking us through every ridiculously bloody death in that film. It's a lot of fun. So do keep your ears peeled for that one. Until then, and until
our Godzilla 2 spoiler special, our Kong versus Godzilla spoiler special, and our Kong versus Jeggers spoiler special. It is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to napalm a giant monkey. And yes, that is a euphemism. I've been Piss Pooit. Thanks for listening. Bye.